Good morning, yes, and a big welcome. The first Saturday in February, pleased to say that I'm catching up with Peter Hegney, who's been an auctioneer here at the horse yearling sales for William Inglis out at Oaklands Junction and all around Australia and overseas for well over three decades. G'day, Pete.
Morning, Brian.
Great to have a chat with you. We're about to head right into a very busy period for you people involved in selling baby thoroughbreds, yearlings as we say, the end of February, coming up at the end of this month. But it basically has been happening around the country with other auction houses, what, since earlier in January?
Yes, it has. We call it the silly season, really, Brian, the yearling sales season. It's very busy, very hectic. Great time, though. It's what we all aim for. We're in the bloodstock agency business. And as you say, yes, they started in January and they'll continue through right until April. And fortunately, I'm involved in most of them.
Now, you're sort of in semi-retirement mode?
Yes, I am, very much so. Well, I've been at it for 40 years and I think it's time to back off. So, yes, I have. I've stepped down quite a bit.
Let's just sort of go back to informing our listeners how this all starts. How horses get to be a yearling to that stage in their life. It's pretty well boy meets girl, stallion meets mare, and it goes from there.
Well, you're right. That's right back to the basics of it, isn't it? But from our point of view, really, we try to keep tabs on and see these horses right from when they're foals right through until they come to the yearling sales. Now, officially, we actually start inspecting them in about September of the year prior to the yearling sales. So we travel on the road for 2 or 3 months as a team, in pairs or singly, going and look at all the horses that are nominated for our sales. Now, each year we have about 2,000 horses, and I'm speaking of Melbourne alone here, we have about 2,000 horses nominated for our major yearling sale, our premier yearling sale. We go out and physically inspect all those 2,000 horses, and as you would understand, they're spread right across Australia. Most of them, of course, in Victoria, but many in New South Wales and South Australia and Queensland, even Western Australia and Tasmania. So we physically inspect those horses for their conformation and their size and growth and correctness. And then we come back to the office and collate the pedigree of the yearling with the physical attributes of the yearling. And theoretically, we'd like to think, we then choose the best, whatever number it may be, 750 to 800 horses for our main sale.
Now, that horse that you're looking at, that yearling, by the time you see it again on sales day, it could be 3 months since you've seen that horse. It'd be a physical change.
Yes, we'd like to think the change is positive, needless to say. But having said that, some horses we'll actually go back and look at 2 and 3 times. If we think that a horse has a future, but it might be a little small, a little backward in physical attributes, we'll certainly go back several times before we actually commit to taking it or rejecting it from our main sale. So we do, in most cases, see them certainly more than once, and sometimes up to 5 and 6 times.
As I mentioned, the mare and the stallion come together. The mare gets into foal. It's a positive mating. The gestation is what, 12 months?
No, 11 months, 11 months, 11 days, I think, or thereabouts, yes.
Right. Now, can the owner of the mare sort of track the progress of the foal to make sure that the foal, they use scans and sort of check up on the progress?
Yes, they can. And these days, of course, x-rays have become quite important in the yearling sales scene. Yearlings can have 45 x-rays taken and be lodged in the repository here at the sales complex so that potential buyers can come and have their veterinarian read the x-rays. Now, some of the major studs these days are in fact taking preliminary x-rays, which are very early when the young horses are only weanlings. And if in fact they've just got a minor problem that needs fixing, it can be fixed so that when the horse comes to the yearling sales and those second lot of x-rays are lodged, then theoretically everything should be clean and all should be well. But yeah, I mean, most owners obviously like to follow their progress. Yes, some of the big studs own their own yearlings, but there are a lot of individual owners out there too who actually entrust their horses to a stud farm to raise it and then in due course to prepare it and bring it to the yearling sales.
It's all about the bone structure with these animals. They're athletes. That structure is so critical.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? You're perfectly right about that, and confirmation means so much in the Yearling Sale Ring these days. But having said that, we often joke amongst ourselves. If you go to the races, of course, and see the 7 or 8 or 9 winners at the end of the day, their confirmation is quite often far, far from correct. But naturally enough, when you go to buy a horse at a yearling sale, you try to buy one as well-conformed, as correctly conformed as you can. We often compare it to two identical cars in a car yard. They've both got the same engine. They're exactly the same. One's got a big scratch down the side and the other one hasn't. You buy the one without the scratch, don't you? And it's a bit the same with horses. We know they all run in different shapes and sizes, big, small, legs on sidewards, backwards, all those things. But for all those that run with those conformational faults, there are a whole swag of them that don't run very fast. And people, generally speaking, it's human nature, like to buy a horse that's as correctly conformed as they can be. And again, needless to say, it's a very subjective thing too. Everybody has, thank goodness, has a different opinion about what they like. We see it all the time, travelling around with trainers and buyers and agents looking at yearlings and getting different opinions. It's one of those industries, as you well know, you never stop learning. So to learn what different individuals like about horses is always interesting to us.
And with a yearling, it can have the best conformation, it can have the best pedigree, it can have the best walk. Everything that you need, every box can be ticked, as they say, but you can't check under the bonnet.
In a funny sort of way, I think that's probably a good thing. If anybody ever invents a recipe how to check under the bonnet, then I guess we'd all be out of business and every best horse in the world would be owned by probably an Arabian sheikh, I guess. So that's the intriguing part of our whole industry. Nobody has yet found that perfect recipe. At some stage or other, everybody claims to have found it, but it's usually pretty short-lived. And again, I'm very pleased that nobody has actually got that recipe.
Now, Pete, when we look at your CV out here at Oaklands Junction, where I speak to you this morning, this beautiful warm morning, autumn morning now, you have claimed to, of course, to have been the man that brought the hammer down to sell Black Caviar.
Yeah, well, that, of course, was just fortuitous and was just the luck of the draw, really. When the auctioneers are allocated their selling runs at each sale, we usually sell about 25 a selling run. It happened that Black Caviar was in my selling run, so really that was not only good luck, not good management, I can assure you. But of course, having said that, I mean, I'm really proud to have been associated with her. It's been a wonderful, wonderful journey, not just for me, of course, but for everybody, the owners, the company itself, the breeders, the trainer, everybody who was involved. So, yeah, I'll certainly remember selling Black Caviar.
What was it about her? Now, we know she was a very big filly, a big race mare, as we know, a wonderful size, but an absolute machine, a terror on the track. Do you recall? I'm sure you do. You recall her coming into the sale ring. Was there something different about her? Bel Esprit out of Helsing. What caught your eye?
Oh, not really, Brian. Obviously, it didn't catch my eye enough. I didn't buy her for myself. I do remember. She, as you say, she was a big filly, certainly. At that stage, you'd have to say she sold above expectations because Bel Esprit was an unproven stallion. She had a nice pedigree, certainly, but nobody obviously could have predicted. Maybe Peter Moody did, but other than that, nobody else predicted that she would be as good as she was. And in fairness to Moods, even he concedes, while he obviously bought her in anticipation of her being a good race mare, nobody would expect her to be the champion that she turned out to be. It was rather strange too, because I think I used a statement just as I was selling her that I don't think I've ever used before, and I don't think I've used it since. But as I was about to knock her down, I said, "Just think what she'll be worth when she wins a Group One." Well, she lived up to those expectations and beyond.
You're a wizard.
A lucky one.
I'm sure that the company William Inglis, which is now in its 150th year of operation, such an iconic name, but all you people involved in that sale with Black Caviar, you must have sort of claimed ownership as she progressed, you know, getting to Royal Ascot, winning those races and seeing the euphoria around this racehorse, unprecedented, not since the days of Farlap, they say.
Yes, we are. We're very proud to have been associated with her. And perhaps good luck beats good management. But we're fortunate that she was offered for sale here in Melbourne. But we've certainly hung on her coattails, unquestionably. We've been really, really proud. We've certainly, obviously, as millions of people have followed her journey through the her race career, and she's just one of those super mares. Yeah, it's really good for racing, apart from obviously for Inglis and all those associated. I think racing needs a champion like that, and we're just very lucky and pleased that she came out of an Inglis Melbourne sale.
How do you become an auctioneer? Now, your racing is in your blood. I knew your dad very well. He's in the Hall of Fame, Graham Hegney. And we'll talk about Graham probably after the commercial break, because he had a wonderful career and trained some champion racehorses. But when did you sort of take, you know, when did you find the fork in the road to say, I want to sell horses?
Probably as a result of going to the sales with my father, quite frankly, back in Adelaide as a young fella. Obviously, I had an interest in horses. Didn't have much option, really. They were in my backyard all of my life, or young life. And I used to go to the sales with my father, and I actually somewhat idolised, might be a strong word, but greatly admired the auctioneer at the time in South Australia of the Bloodstock Agency, which was Coles Bloodstock Agency. And the patriarch of that was a man named David Coles, a very, very fine man, and still to this day the best auctioneer that I've ever heard, and certainly the best one I've ever worked with. Wonderful man. And it was just one of those things that I thought, I think I'd like to do that. And so eventually down the track, the opportunity came to for me to do so. So, but that's basically where it all started.
The old Wavell Showgrounds, is that where they used to sell over in South Australia?
Yep, very much so. Yeah, it's pretty basic in those days, but perfectly adequate. That's all that was expected of a sales complex, a horse sales complex. But it was at the Showgrounds, yes. And just moved in there. The horses moved in there 2 or 3 or 4 days before the sale. It was a different operation, of course. It was much slower back in those days. We are now talking, 55 or nearly 60 years ago, I guess, when I went to my first sales. It was much slower. We used to start later in the day. We'd break for dinner and break for afternoon tea, and you'd sell about 15 or 20 an hour. It was a much slower process. But nevertheless, David Coles, as an auctioneer, was a commanding man. He certainly commanded the whole auction, and he's been unquestionably the most influence in my auctioneering life.
It's an interesting comment. Yes, I knew David. He was a wonderful man, and was such a great servant to the industry in South Australia. But of course, when you look at that Wavell Showgrounds complex through Coles and the sales there, the great Manicato came through the ring.
Yes, he did. Manicato, needless to say, was before my time selling, but he certainly was sold through there. There's a bit of a story. I mean, as you would well recall, Manicato was a most impressive horse himself. Big, strong, strapping, good sort of horse. Yes, not perfectly conformed, all those things. Didn't sell for a lot of money. The story goes he was actually raised in a backyard in the suburbs of Adelaide. Not sure whether that's true, but I believe it to be. In fact, I did know the people who bred him.
Yeah, the people were Truscott.
Truscott, yeah, yes, absolutely.
I've actually been to that property. When we did the video, The King and the Man, we went and met Mr. Truscott and saw the little box in the backyard where Manicato was raised.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, so it sort of breaks all the rules, doesn't it, about these great racehorses having to be raised in good pastures and big paddocks and all those sorts of things. But, yeah, he was a super horse, unquestionably, Manicato.
And the move to from South Australia across here, that probably came sort of with your dad when he'd bring horses across?
Well, it did, although my permanent move over here certainly didn't occur during that time. I used to, as you may recall, I worked with my father for some years and used to travel to Melbourne, yes, travel interstate with his horses and with his racing team. But the move to Victoria permanently came about as a result of Dad's retirement and me having to make the decision whether I wanted to continue training or not. And after much angst and consideration, I decided perhaps wasn't quite the way I wanted to go. And that's when the opportunity came up for me to get into the Bloodstock Agency business.
Did you get cut out of the will?
No, well, as you'd remember, my father was a workaholic. He was a seven-day-a-week man. He wasn't great at delegating and was an extremely hard worker. He achieved his success by working really, really hard and being really hands-on. And I must say, I'd seen the other side of life a bit. I enjoyed life, and I wasn't quite sure I was dedicated enough. As much as I loved the training aspect, loved it a lot, loved achieving, getting a horse fit and well and winning a race with it, but I wasn't quite sure I wanted to dedicate my 7 days a week to training racehorses. So that's when I had to make the decision.
I condense all that down to say I don't want to bloody get up early in the morning.
Dad could never understand sometimes how I was coming home for a night out as he was getting up to go to work. I guess you're right in some respects, yes.
Peter Hegney, my special guest this morning. Great to catch up with Peter. Auctioneer extraordinaire and one of the great guys of racing with, of course, William Inglis. We're taking a break. We're here for Toven Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. I'm with Peter Hegney this morning and we're talking about his life in racing. His life basically has been taken up of something like 34 years with auctioneering, being the auctioneer of thoroughbred racehorses, and it's taken him around the world. He was invited back in 2008 to be an auctioneer at the famous Tattersall's December sale. That's fantastic.
Well, it's actually been nearly 40 years, by the way, Brian. Okay. I'm a bit embarrassed.
Catch us some slack.
My Tattersall's trip was one of the most amazing things in my auctioneering life, unquestionably. I think, to my knowledge, I was the first non-European to sell at a Tattersall sale in England. As you know, it's steeped in history even more so than the English company itself. Wonderful, wonderful opportunity. I readily concede that I don't think I sold particularly well over there. I went over there, I guess a little egotistically, thinking that, we're in Australia doing a bit better than they do over there. But I came to earth with a thump, I've got to admit. But having said that, it's one of the great experiences of my life. I have three things, I think, in my auctioneering history that were the highlights. The first of them being the first time I was asked to sell at the Easter yearling sale for Inglis. The second one was when I was actually asked to open the Easter yearling sale, which was a great privilege. And thirdly, selling at Tattersall sale in England. Just a wonderful, wonderful opportunity, great experience, so much history, tradition over there. That's something I'll never forget and I'll forever be appreciative of.
Were you nervous?
Yes, I was nervous. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, to go over the other side of the world and like Peter Moody taking black caviar over there, I suppose. Yes, I was nervous. Interestingly, people often ask, do you get nervous when you sell, having done it for 40 years? My answer to that is I'm not sure it's actually called nervousness these days, although at Tattersall's it was. But if you don't get an adrenaline rush, then I sometimes question whether you should be doing it. You've got to have a little bit of nerves, I think, when you get up and do something like that. So you're dealing with people's livelihoods here in many cases. You're selling horses that they've nurtured from, as we said earlier, from the mating days and then right through to sale time. And in many cases, it's people's livelihood. So it's a very, very serious business. I mean, occasionally we can get lighthearted and a touch flippant about it, but at the same time, we've got to be mindful of the fact that it is really, at the end of the day, a very serious business. So yes, back to your question, was I nervous? Yes, I was nervous.
Pete, if I breed a horse and I get selected to go in the Premier Yearling Sale, which is the biggest sale in Melbourne, naturally I think that's the best horse that's in the catalogue because I bred it. What's the process? How long is my horse in the ring for? What's the set time? How does it work?
Well, as I said a little earlier too, things have changed somewhat. We certainly get through a lot more horses now than we used to in an hour. We'd like to think we sell approximately 30 an hour, so obviously it's about 2 minutes in the ring. The difference is too, I recall again back in the David Coles days, where we used to virtually repeat the spiel that's already printed in the catalogue ahead of you. We'd start off by saying this horse was bred by the great breeder in the Adelaide Hills and that magnificent property up there. Then you'd go through the spiel about the dam of the horse, how she won 6 races including 2 at Victoria Park and 1 at Port Adelaide and 2 at Morphettville, and so you'd go on. And it was a long, drawn-out process. Now, that's no longer required. People don't want to hear that anymore. They don't want to hear something that might have happened in the pedigree recently, something that can highlight an addition. But at the end of the day, the buyers, generally speaking, have made up their mind. And occasionally you might be able to cajole an extra 1 bid or 2 or 3 bids, perhaps, out of a buyer. But the principle of repeating what's in the catalogue is no longer necessary. And that's where it's changed quite dramatically. And furthermore, we sell a lot more horses in a day, in a sale, than we used to sell, of course. So we have to get through them a lot quicker.
But what happens if a yearling comes in the size of an ant and you say it's got 2 minutes and then 2 or 3 lots further down, the showstopper arrives that might be climbing towards $1 million. You're going to give him more than 2 minutes, surely.
Of course, we'll leave them in there. While people are bidding, they can be in there for 30 minutes if the people are still bidding. Well, the ant you speak about, we hope it's not the Premier Sale, needless to say, but in that case, we would be talking about the pedigree. We would certainly be highlighting the pedigree.
And the handler.
Well, we hope the handler's got some attributes to talk about. You're right, but yes, of course, if there's a good horse comes in and there's animated bidding, and the bidding is still going, of course we'll keep going as long as we need to.
Let's talk about your dad, Graham Hegney, as I mentioned, Hall of Fame trainer. Trainer extraordinaire in so many ways, and I knew your dad well. He prepared a great horse as I grew up, and I think a lot of listeners tuned in this morning would remember the mighty horse, the chestnut horse, Tobin Bronze.
Yeah, super horse, wasn't he? Great horse. Yes, I think one of his great attributes, Tobin Bronze, apart from obviously being a wonderful, wonderful racehorse, was his physicality. He was such an impressive horse. He was a great colour, really, really rich bronze chestnut, wasn't he? A lovely horse, had a great temperament as well. I wasn't actually working with my father at the time. The horse, of course, was in the stables behind our house, so I saw a lot of him. But I think all those things combined is what endeared him to the racing public. His good race record, and obviously what an impressive horse he was.
I remember him vividly. My brother and I were teenagers. We're on the flat at Moonee Valley when he won that second Cox Plate in 67. He won it in 66 and 67. He had a great year in 67, as we know. And I remember him parading this copper coloured, beautiful looking animal, Jimmy Johnson aboard, purple with the white spots, the colours of the Brown family from Adelaide, but parading down the straight, and the ovation that he got on Cox Plate Day, because it was the last hurrah. He was bowing out of Australian racing. And your dad did an interview many years later with us at Race Play with one of our videos on Great Champions. And he spoke, and there was a tear in his eye, and he spoke of people trying to pull strands from the horse's tail as a memento. And it was just one of those great moments of the racecourse.
Yes, I'm sure you're quite right about that. And I think I'm right in saying that the late, great race caller Bill Collins said that the reception that Tobin Bronze received that day was the greatest reception he'd ever heard on a race course. And as you know, he'd called plenty of races and seen plenty of race meetings. He was a very, very popular horse, unquestionably, and it was rather sad that he did bow out and go to America after that second Cox Plate win.
And your dad at the time, of course, trained him, and two Americans purchased him to go to race in America. And he did okay. He ran in the Washington, D.C. International, which was probably the biggest race in the world at the time, and won a couple of other races, and he wasn't settling in for the trainer over there, and your dad was invited to go over and look after him.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Brian. He ran third in that Washington International. He had a pretty rugged trip over on the plane, and in fact, I remember Dad saying that it was the only time that Tobin Bronze ever kicked. And I think the horse was just so fed up. He'd spent so much time on airports and planes and being held up. And so he wasn't at all well when he went into that Washington International, which at the time was, as you said, one of the biggest races, perhaps the biggest race in the world. But he still ran a very creditable third in that race. And then, yes, he did. He went to Charlie Whittingham over there, who's a leading trainer, of course, on the west coast of America. Charlie trained him, and Charlie couldn't quite get him right. So the owners asked Dad if he'd go over and just help, which he did. Dad, at that stage, I might add, wasn't enjoying the best of health, so it sort of suited him to scale down a bit. He had Mick Robins back in Adelaide and Melbourne as his foreman at the time. So Dad went over and helped them with Tobin Bronze. And yes, he did win more races afterwards. He never really came back to the level that he was in Australia, but he certainly, again, raced creditably before he went to stud over there.
Now, in going to America and making that call to follow and assist with Tobin Bronze, and why wouldn't you? What a great opportunity and what a great horse. But behind he left in the stable in Adelaide, Bunratty Castle and the great Rain Lover.
Yeah, it was interesting, wasn't it? One of those things you reflect on, I suppose. Dad had won the Adelaide Cup with Rain Lover. and then had to hand him over to Mick Robins, who, as I said, had been his foreman for a number of years. And Mick took him over, and then he, well, the rest is history. He went on to win two Melbourne Cups. But it's just one of those things. It's just how timing was. Of course, Dad was a bit sad not to have won the two Melbourne Cups with Ryan Lover, but pleased for Mick, and just the way the world goes.
And we should never lose sight of the fact that your dad won the cup for the Reed family, the Reed brothers, with a horse called Gaddam Gaddam in 1963.
Yes, he did, yes. 33-1, I recall, I think. I was at school at that time. But, yeah, that was a great win. Dad, I think, was notorious for, well known, should I say, for getting horses extremely fit. He was a pretty tough trainer, hard trainer, one of those good old-fashioned trainers who fed well and worked them hard. And I remember Dad saying that he didn't know whether Gaddam Gaddam was good enough to win a Melbourne Cup, but he was certainly fit enough. He said he couldn't get him any fitter. I remember my mother, who, I might add, apart from doing the books for my father, knew nothing or very little about horses at all. All she was concerned about that he didn't run last. Well, fortunately, it was the other end of the race. Yeah, it was a great win. It was really pleasing. The Reeds, who owned the horse, had invested a lot of money over a lot of years in South Australia in horses. And it was a really satisfying win for Dad to win that cup.
And Peter, through the stable back in the 60s, there was another terrific two-year-old called Proud Miss. I think she won something like 10 in a row, would that be right, before she ran in the Golden Slipper?
Yes, she did, Brian. Yes, she did win 10 in a row, including an open sprint in South Australia. Yes, she was outstanding at the time. And while the Golden Slipper then was a good race, it probably, well, needless to say, it didn't carry anything like the percentage of prize money that it does now. And it didn't have quite the aura about it as it does now, but was certainly a top two-year-old race. Yes, she was an outstanding filly, and she, well, she'd had 10 runs, which was a fair number for a two-year-old before running in the Golden Slipper. She was unbeaten leading into that, and unfortunately she went a bit hard, a bit fast early, and just got pipped on the line by a filly named Birthday Card. Mm. But she was a super filly, an outstanding filly.
I remember her well, and as you said, at 2 years of age, she won an open sprint. And of course, having a two-year-old's weight in an open sprint would have been about 7-2 or something like that in the old. And I reckon a guy called Leon Corsons might have ridden her.
Your memory is probably better than mine, but you may well be right, because Leon, of course, was apprenticed to my father in South Australia, so that could well be right.
Yeah, and your dad, Bluey Hegney, as we knew him, Graham Hegney, he actually was a Victorian. Was apprenticed to a man called Ferguson, would that be right?
Yes, absolutely right. Yes, he rode, obviously, as a jockey in Victoria with moderate success. By his own admission, he doesn't claim to be a great jockey, but he had reasonable success. I know, I think he created some sort of record riding a horse called Typical for the most consecutive races any jockey had ridden one horse, and I can't remember the number, but I know it was
about
a big
75.
Number. It was a lot, I do recall that. And I might add, he was a very, very good horse too. So yeah, Dad rode in Victoria before moving to South Australia.
And those good gallopers, Ali Azar, and horses like, as we mentioned, Proud Miss. Idaloo was a fan, was a horse that I was a real fan of. Lovely, striking-looking horse, raced by a Mr. Bellow, would that be right?
Yes, absolutely, who had a very top-class restaurant in South Australia. Interesting with Idaloo, he was a good horse. He won two Futurities. But my father always used to say he was the best, worst horse he ever trained. He didn't think he had a very big heart, so you had to really nurture him very carefully. He was of light constitution. I remember the horse well, by Artemenio. He was a light-framed horse, so you had to treat him with kid gloves all the time. But when you got him right, as you said, he was a good horse.
Johnny Letts was over to ride him. Might have been the Newmarket Handicap going back in the 70s, and Johnny and I were walking the track, and it was sort of about 6 o'clock at night. It was still daylight the night before. I remember the track ranger coming on, throwing us off the course. Never forget it. And the horse ran terrible the next day.
Well, that's what he was a bit inclined to do. He could put in a good one and put in a bad one as well. But as we said, when he was right, he was good.
So you were doing sort of like foreman work, working with Dad, travelling the horses, etc. And you obviously enjoyed that, but didn't want to pursue it sort of long term.
Well, I had an auctioneer. When I left school, I had an auctioneering background with a stock and station agency, Dalgetty's in South Australia. There were no openings at the time in the bloodstock industry, so I went into the stock side of things with Dalgetty's, and that gave me the opportunity to start my auctioneering career. I recall a group of 15 or 20 of us, young fellas with Dalgetty's, had an auctioneering school to see whether any of us had any potential, any attribute to auctioneering, and a few of us obviously came through it okay, and fortunately I was one of those, so that gave me the chance to get started in the auctioneering side of things, which I did for about 7 or 8 years. I travelled the country and used to sell sometimes 2 and 3 and 4 days a week selling livestock. Then the opportunity actually came up for me to travel to America to take the Derby winner, Always There, over to America. Now, my father didn't train him, Charlie Weymouth did, but he was owned by a big owner for whom Dad had trained, in Philippe Ismail, and they asked, needed somebody to take the horse across to America to look after him over there, so I did that. And I spent 6 months in the States with Always There. Now, unfortunately, he didn't get to race over there. When I came back, I then had to make the decision whether I wanted to go back to the stock and station agency business or stay at home and work with my father, which I did. And again, I did that for about 7 or 8 years. It was the time when Dad, again, wasn't enjoying the best of health and was, had to make some decisions whether he wanted to go on and, furthermore, whether I wanted to go on training. And as I said earlier, I wasn't quite sure I was dedicated as he was, and I knew if I wasn't totally dedicated, then there was no point in me doing it. It was all or nothing. And fortunately, the opportunity came up with Dalgetty's on the bloodstock side of things to go into the horse selling agencies. And so that's when, yes, my selling career started in auctioneering horses.
Interesting times in racing. Peter Hegney, my guest. We're taking a break for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest this morning on This Is Your Racing Life, we're looking at the racing life of Peter Hegney, auctioneer here with the William Inglis, semi-retired, but I don't think you don't actually retire away from the sport, do you?
No, I guess not. It's something you love. I mean, that's one of the fortunate things, I think, in this industry, or certainly for me, in that my vocation has been my life, what I enjoy, what I love doing. Yes, fortunately, I love auctioneering, but I love horses, I love racing, I love the breeding side of it. So it's not really been a task to go to work each day, Brian.
Interesting. Just before we went for the break, you spoke about Dalgetty's and working for Dalgetty's, and Dalgetty's actually established this complex in the early 80s out here at Oaklands Junction. I remember it well. Graham Campbell was the principal here in Melbourne, the late Graham Campbell. The history sort of shows that the selling auction house was McKinnon Cox, I think, from memory, then later on Wright Stevenson, then Dalgetty's, then, of course, William Inglis. Now, when did William Inglis take over from Dalgetty's here?
They bought the business in 94, conducted their first yearling sale here in 94, and that was the stage where I was appointed manager of the operation here. I had been, of course, with Dalgetty's prior to that, and as you said, Dalgetty bought the business back at Flemington off Wright Stevenson.
Mm. Now, Pete, in your time, as you say, once William Inglis took over the management here, you've had a very good innings, well in excess of, 22 years. What an incredible company it is, established in 1867, so they've been selling horses for 150 years.
Yes, quite amazing, and 5 generations of the family running it too, which I think even adds more mystique to the whole company, quite frankly. It's a company steeped in history, wonderful family company, and the tradition carries on, and let's hope it carries on for many, many more years. Their acquisition of the Melbourne operation in 94 was probably quite interesting, because prior to that, of course, each state had its own sales agency. There was one in Queensland, one in Inglis and Sydney, Dalgetty's in Melbourne, and so on. So it probably was quite a drastic move for them. Now, it turned out to be very fortuitous too, because the market in 92 and 3 had been a little bit flat. In 94, with absolutely no credit to my input, but the market turned around, and the average that year was up some 30%. So the Melbourne acquisition of Dalgetty's by Inglis has turned out to be very fortuitous for them.
The market, the global financial sort of status is terribly important, naturally, when you're selling thoroughbred racehorses?
The general economy, yes, Brian, it does. We often say that our industry sort of revolves around the stock market, quite frankly. If the stock market's buoyant and well, then our industry is usually quite good. And conversely, of course, if the whole economy around the place is depressed, then people don't want to buy racehorses. I mean, I always say that you need to feed your family, you need to have a house, but you don't need to have a racehorse. So principally, it's people with money that they can afford to spare and spend. Obviously, some people take it very, very seriously as an industry in buying their horses. Everybody endeavours to make it a viable venture, of course, but at the end of the day, it's probably what people enjoy doing. And whatever you do for your enjoyment, whether you're buying a speedboat or a surfboard or a tennis racket, whatever it might be, golf membership, it costs you a bit of money. But and that's a bit what racing's like too. If you want to have some enjoyment, then it's likely to cost you a bit of money. We all hope, of course, at the end of the day, that doesn't cost you too much money. In fact, we hope you can make some money out of it.
How does the company handle, like, when they've got to take a hit with a horse like the relation to Black Caviar that went under the title of Jimmy, and we know what the fallout from that was? The company had to take a pretty decent whack there.
Well, yes, but fortunately insurance did help us out considerably. It's just part of business, I suppose, Brian, really. Look, we like to think we control our financial arrangements and credit arrangements well, and I would have to say over my term with the company, they have done exactly that. But like any business, I suppose, if something dramatic happens like that, then you just have to be able to manage it. I mean, it had happened previously, of course, as you may recall, before my time, I might add, with Inglis, with the Bart Cummings situation many, many years ago, of course. They survived that. I'm not too sure that a lot of companies could have survived it as well as Inglis did, but they survived that, and they certainly survived the Jimmy situation. But again, as I say, fortunately, financially, that wasn't so dramatic because there was insurance coverage on most of that.
Just explain who Jimmy was.
Jimmy was the brother to Black Caviar that was sold at the Easter yearling sale for some $5 million. It was one of my highlights and lowlights, needless to say, of my auctioneering career. Having sold Black Caviar and having sold her half-sister and having sold Jimmy as well, $5 million was a lot of money. There was a fair bit of pressure on, needless to say, when I was selling him. And it was great, of course. It was advertised or promoted, should I say, all over Australia and beyond, I think. The result wasn't so good, as we well know. But anyway, we've moved on.
And he died through a spider bite.
Yes, apparently, and got an infection as a result of that. Yeah. It was really, really sad. I mean, a horse like that, it had an enormous future, both as a racehorse and a potential stallion. So it was really, really disappointing for the breeder, of course, Rick Jamieson. He was devastated, as much as the owners were and we were, because we too like to see our high-priced sale graduates go to the racecourse and succeed.
Peter, when a horse is presented at the yearling sales, what's the situation as far as drug testing, etc., goes?
They're able to be tested, Brian, for, and it's only been brought in recent times, for steroids. Look, quite frankly, I think these days most of the horses that are presented at our sales are presented drug-free. It's not in vendors' interests, long-term or short-term, to present horses with any drugs in them. We introduced steroid testing, all agencies did, just a few years ago, but since that has been introduced, there hasn't been one positive result for steroids in any yearling that has been tested. So I think that in itself is reflective of the fact that it just doesn't happen anymore. And as I say, it's not in anybody's interest for vendors to be presenting horses with any drugs in them. There are some horses that can, of course, be given something. They may have just given themselves a small knock, have a small swelling, a little stiffness. But provided a treatment sheet is lodged, which is available in the repository for any potential buyer, then that is perfectly acceptable.
Just driving here this morning to this wonderful complex here on such a beautiful morning, it's such a quiet place when there's nothing happening, you know, in terms of the auction. Because when you come, and that's most of the time that we do come here, the auction's in full swing or about to happen. There are, you know, there are cars parked everywhere, but it's the constant cry of the winning in the background, and the noise that horses make, horses coming out and being inspected, etc. The banter of you, the auctioneer, or Simon Vivian, or your colleagues in the background, and it's got this marketplace, fantastic atmosphere, but when that's not happening, it's very quiet, very silent.
Nice place to work, isn't it? We have the best of both worlds, I think, out here. You're right. It's a good venue. As I say, it's well established now. It's well accepted. I think it's a sale complex that's comparable to any in the world, quite frankly. We spoke earlier about Tattersall's, and it's a wonderful complex, but it's very sprawling and spread out and covers a massive area of ground. But this complex here is well received now by both buyers and sellers, and yes, it's quiet externally. Internally, it's pretty hectic in the offices, which are located out here too, of course. But the sale itself, at sale time, yeah, I think it has a real sense of excitement and a buzz about it. As an auctioneer, I never tire of auctions. I love going to auctions, be it a horse auction, a cattle auction, a car auction, any sort of auction. I really, really enjoy them. And I think if anybody has any remote interest in horses and racing at all, I certainly encourage them to come out here and experience an auction, because it does have an atmosphere, it does have a buzz, an aura about it. I think it's certainly well worthwhile for anybody to come out here, and they shouldn't be intimidated by thinking, oh, they're going to be scared, they're going to buy a horse or put their hand up at the wrong time. That, believe me, certainly doesn't happen. Everybody is always welcome out here.
I think one of your best days is the day before you sell, like inspection day, and you see a huge crowd roll up out here at Oaklands Junction. Good time to come out, because you can see the trainers plying their trade, looking at horses and bloodstock agents, etc. And it's just wonderful to watch the process. You don't have to be in the sale ring. You can go there just as an onlooker, and a lot of tire kickers, I suppose you call them, but it's a good way to sort of work out and just get your head around how the whole process operates.
Well, it certainly is. As you say, it's usually pretty busy that day before the sales. Trainers doing last-minute inspections. Inspections start for a yearling sale nearly a week before the sale itself commences these days. That has expanded a lot. Hitherto, it was maybe 2 days, perhaps three, but now it's going to be 4, 5, 6, 7 days before the sale, when the first of the yearlings arrive on the sale complex. And as soon as they arrive, buyers are out here inspecting, because when you've got a catalogue of some nearly 800 horses, it does take a lot to get through. Now, fortunately, some of the buyers go out onto the farms in the couple of weeks prior to the sale and inspect there, but the majority unquestionably are inspected here on the sales complex. So the day before the sale, yeah, it's a good time for people to come out and have a look and see all the buyers, and then if they're interested enough, follow up the next day and come to the auction.
Pete, you must be proud of the gallery of stars that have come through this ring here.
Well, yes, we are. We've sold some great horses over the years. It's always nice to see, as I said, our graduates go on to succeed. We've had, you know, champion sprinters of the world, champion horses of the world, champions in Hong Kong, champions in South Africa come through our sale ring here. And I think that's probably what encourages and prompts those buyers to come back. We have a good contingent of South Africans, because the horses that they've bought from here have gone over there and performed very well. We've had great success in Hong Kong as well. And as a result, those buyers come back here. And, we should too, because Victorians and Australians generally, of course, can breed great horses. And, yeah, we're proud of the graduates.
Our VOBIS scheme, a scheme that assists in if you do buy through the Premier's sale, just seems to be a fantastic fillip, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. A wonderful, wonderful bonus. Quite frankly, Brian, I've unashamedly said many times, if somebody is racing in Victoria, I can't encourage them enough to have a VOBIS, Super VOBIS qualified yearling. Now, in fairness, if you're going to pay $1 million, I suppose it doesn't really matter what bonuses you're eligible for. You're buying a horse to win a Golden Slipper or a Blue Diamond or a Melbourne Cup, whatever it may be. But generally speaking, if you're racing in Victoria, I would have thought that it's almost imperative to have a Super VOBIS qualified yearling, quite frankly.
How do you relax, Pete, away from here?
I'm about to find out, Brian, when I fully retire. I'm not quite sure yet. I'm a bit involved in the equestrian world, as I have been over a long period of time. I I have a small acreage that always takes up a lot of time. My wife's still involved in the equestrian side of things too, so obviously I'll be supporting her. I have first grandchildren, so I'll hopefully be spending time with them. Mm-hmm. Believe me, I think I'll find plenty of things to do in my spare time.
Well, you're one of the good guys of racing. You're admired by so many within the industry, not just in Australia, but globally. But happy retirement when you finally do it. And good luck, of course, with the Premier Yearling Sale. It looks a fabulous catalogue. 26th, 27th, 28th of February and the 1st of March. It's coming up to showtime.
Well, as I said, it's what we work for. So looking forward to it, Brian. And thank you very much.